Thank you. That was the world premiere of Nishat Khan's first sitar concerto, The Gate of the Moon. We heard it live here at the BBC Proms and here on BBC Radio 3 and BBC Asian Network.
Now, Susie, some of the things that really struck me about today, because it was my first prom, was the fact that I'd never thought a sitar, that one instrument, would be able to hold its own with a full orchestra. But it danced in and out of the music. It was on top of the music. It existed below the music as well. And that's testament to the power of this man.
I think both to his power as a composer and also as a performer. He told us earlier today he wasn't remotely worried about performing. He was very worried about how the audience here would take it. He desperately wanted people to appreciate the spirit, the generosity of spirit with which he'd intended it. Played here brilliantly, I thought, tonight by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, led by Leslie Hatfield. And also worth saying, a fabulous orchestration, I think. Pete Stacey, who orchestrated that concerto, brilliant, glistening sound from the orchestra.
I think also for Nishat, the one thing we don't realise, he was really working outside of his own Indian classical comfort zone. And I think that's what he was worried about earlier on when he was talking about actually bringing this to the people in this hall tonight.
I mean, I felt, given that he is one of the world's leading exponents of this instrument, such a humble and generous-spirited man. He really wanted, he cared very much if people liked and enjoyed his piece. As we said earlier, 20 years in the making, there's a little bit of his heart in this, or a big bit.
And as he also said earlier on, he wanted people, the kinds of people who might listen to the Asian Network, to be able to connect with a piece of music like this, even if they didn't necessarily listen to classical music. And I think he may have done that as well tonight.
It was about, for him, he said, and here he comes back on stage full of smiles now. I think he's pretty happy with how it went, shall we say. Back on stage with David Atherton, tonight's conductor, and Nishat Khan giving very warm applause to the orchestra. Such a generous musician. But that brilliant fusion there of Indian classical music, he said, influences of Bach and Mozart and Beethoven, an Indian popular song, and none of it forced, all of it just coming sort of filtered through his experience and his instinct, his love for all that music.
As a fan of popular music in India as well, I could hear exactly what he was talking about. There were elements, dare I say it, of some Bollywood compositions going into that piece, even though that's most probably a heresy for some people listening right now.
Could never, ever be a heresy. It's interval time here at the Royal Albert Hall, and also, rather sadly, time to bid goodbye to Mr. Bobby Friction and to the Asian Network. It was your first experience with Proms. It was a good experience?
It was a good experience, which I will repeat again next year, hopefully with you again, Susie.
I'm formally asking you back. I don't know if anybody else approves of that, but we would love to have you back. What was the thing I want to know that really struck you about today as a kind of newbie to the Proms? Was there anything that felt particularly exciting about being here?
Yeah, look, I'm a fan of live music. I'm a fan of live rock music and many other types of music. To me, selling this to a rock fan, a fan of popular music, I'd say, you think some live guitarists on stage are brilliant? Come and see a full orchestra on stage. You don't have to be a fan of classical music to just feel the power, the gut power of a live band, a live orchestra on stage. So I'm actually going to start preaching the gospel from tomorrow.
Good. We want as many converts as possible. And I love the idea of that Venn diagram between BBC Radio 3 listeners, BBC Asian Network, and all of those people with their very different musical interests, some of them shared musical interests, enjoying that kind of descending on tonight's concert as a way into kind of new musical avenues potentially for everybody.
So BBC 3 listeners, or should I say BBC Radio 3 listeners, you know where the BBC Asian Network is. It's a beautiful digital station that exists somewhere in your hearts and heads, hopefully.
Oh, stop plugging your station. That's enough. We'll see you next year. Great to have you here, Bobby. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Susie. Now back for our BBC Asian Network listeners to Anushka on the BBC Asian Network.
Meanwhile, here on Radio 3, our thanks again to Bobby Friction. Fantastic to have you here with us this evening. And Radio 3 listeners, do not go anywhere. We have more coming up after the interval here at the Royal Albert Hall. It's going to be Vaughan Williams' Second Symphony, his London Symphony. And that is the subject of our Proms Plus event, recorded earlier on this evening across the road at the Royal College of Music, where the presenter was Louise Fryer.
Vaughan Williams' Second Symphony, a London Symphony, was completed 100 years ago this year. And to discuss it, I'm joined by Dr. Kate Kennedy from Girton College, Cambridge, who's a specialist in earlier 20th century poetry and music and also a freelance cellist, and by Stephen Johnson, who coincidentally started out playing the cello. He's recently moved to piano, but he's better known as a writer and a broadcaster with a limitless knowledge of music on just about everything from every time and place. His documentary on Vaughan Williams in 2008 received a Gold Sony Award. Now, Vaughan Williams significantly revised his symphony over a period of 20 years, not least making it at least 10 minutes shorter. And it's that revised version that we're going to be hearing tonight. Four movements, fast, slow, scherzo, and finale. And it's interesting that he uses actual sounds of London in the symphony. Was his intention to be straightforwardly pictorial, or is there more to it than that?
I think there's so much more to it than that. I think this is more than program music, not to belittle program music, but it's doing something different. This is a symphony by a Londoner for London. And I think what he's trying to do, in keeping with many other artists and intellectuals in different genres and different mediums at the time, is to give a snapshot of Edwardian London and what it actually felt like to be part of the society, and trying to give us some kind of sense reflected back to ourselves as a contemporary audience of where Edwardian London and Edwardian Britain was at this particular very critical point just before the outbreak of the First World War. I mean, the decade leading up to the war has been described as a long garden party. And in some senses, there was that sense of calm and stillness. But actually, to Vaughan Williams, living through that, this was a sense of a doomed calm. It was a stillness that was to be shattered. And we have to struggle to get that sense, I think, when we look back retrospectively, knowing the Armageddon that was to come. But there were, H.G. Wells describes it as a sense of a strained optimism. There were structures, beliefs, you know, the role of women, all these things that had somehow ossified under Queen Victoria's very long reign. And so there were violent factions pushing for change. We had suffragettes, you know, putting jam in letterboxes, throwing themselves under racehorses. We had the Cat and Mouse Act, the violent opposition to change. And so this was a sense of calm that really couldn't last. And in a lot of work at the time, we get a sense that intellectuals are aware that this is about to change, that there is a sense of decay, there is a sense that there's something very worthwhile that ought to be held onto, but that also all this is crumbling around us. And so what Vaughan Williams is doing, rather than giving us, you know, a jolly tromp through London, and you know, here we are passing Westminster Chimes, and here's a Cockney chap whistling. It's infinitely more than that. It's all sorts of aspects of what it means to be in London, what it means to be British at this time.
What does he pick out musically to create that sense of an underclass, of the kind of darker, seedier side of London?
Well, that's interesting, because this is by far Vaughan Williams' most revised symphony. And a lot of the revision had to do with tightening it up structurally. But in some ways, he actually muted that dark message. If you listen to the original version of the symphony, which is now available in a recording, there's a lot more of the darkness and the strangeness and the sense of alienation even in that. Particularly, there's a bizarre and extraordinary passage at the heart of the scherzo, which is about 4 or 5 minutes long, which he actually removed wholesale. Fascinatingly, there was almost a campaign at the time to get him to put it back. Arnold Bax wrote him a letter, the composer, begging him to return this passage to the symphony.
There actually was a public campaign. There were people writing into the Musical Times and Music and Criticism saying, you know, I really like this bit when I first heard it. Where's it gone?
It is a moment when suddenly London turns on its dark side. Mm. We'll be turning to H.G. Wells' novel Tono Bungay and the relevance of that later, but H.G. Wells has his character in this. He talks about the constant sense of the terror of the grim underside of London. And underneath all this seeming Cockney merrymaking, which Vaughan Williams himself said is the music of the slums, the south side of the river, suddenly the scherzo turns much darker, and there's some very strange writing of a kind that, if you know the symphony well, it's rather surprising to hear.
Absolutely. And following on from that quote from Wells, I mean, George Butterworth, the wonderful, promising young composer who was here at the Royal College, who was killed on the Somme, was a great friend of Vaughan Williams and gave him the idea to write this symphony, talks about the final movement as being a kind of grim struggle, a delight in the struggle with imperfection. There's something about that. There's something almost delighting in this darkness. but also absolutely embracing it and presenting it to us. And I think there's so much darkness in the symphony that perhaps Vaughan Williams felt that he needed to balance it somehow, because although, as you say, it is a much darker work without the cuts, there's ample darkness there left in these wonderful sort of grim, solitary moments, particularly in the epilogue.
Mm. Well, we have just an opportunity now to hear a little bit from the bit of the scherzo that was excised. So this is as dark as it could have got.
Yes, it's very, very striking there. Vaughan Williams has different instruments playing in different keys at the same time, which would have been a very radical sound indeed in London in 1911. Mm. Extraordinary.
Absolutely.
And then he decided to edit it out after his own experiences in the First World War, and as you say, after George Butterworth was killed in the war. Do you think that's why there was an element of he just couldn't face looking back at it?
I don't think so. I think it might have affected how he would have written from then onwards. I don't think he would have edited the darkness retrospectively out of his work. I think probably more prosaically is to do with a matter of balance. When he did, it was 50 minutes long, it was too long, and he did go round after the premiere asking his friends what he ought to cut out, which is wonderfully Vaughan Williams and wonderfully modest. And I don't know why he would have chosen to cut such an emotional... He sort of cuts the heart out of this movement in a way, doesn't he? It seems a strange edit.
It's the one cut I wish he hadn't made.
Yes, yes. But it
is interesting. I think that the whole process about how the symphony changed as he revised it over quite a long period, by the time he finished, I think this is in the 1930s, mm-hmm. his ideal of the symphony had changed. He'd really embraced Sibelius, the idea of a concentration, economy, of a symphony with a very strong sense of purpose. Yep. Was now central to his own idea of the symphony. At the time he wrote the London Symphony, and this is interesting because I don't know how much Mahler he knew, I don't think it can have been very much,
No. But
his concept of the symphony seems to be here very much Mahlerian. The symphony must be like the world, it must embrace everything, Mahler famously said. This is what he seems to be doing in the London Symphony. And it's, I think his main preoccupation was that he'd gone too far, he felt, in later years, and that actually he had to bring this symphony in line with his later symphonic thinking. I think on the whole he did it extremely well, mm-hmm. except, as you say, it's
this
a terrible shame about
that
passage in the scherzo.
Yeah.
But he was very keen to promote the idea of an English symphony, to become a composer of English symphonies.
And I think it's interesting, for a start, that he chooses a symphony. And as I say, Butterworth encouraged him to turn some sort of sketches that he had about London into it, to throw them into symphonic form, as he puts it. But in a sense, despite the fact that we have Sibelius and we have Shostakovich and we have Walton, people who are pushing the symphony forwards in the 20th century, it still has the feel at this time of being an old form. And what Vaughan Williams is wanting to say is absolutely contemporary and very new. So I think what he's taking is this idea of inclusion that you mentioned, this, because essentially what a symphony is a work that offers a number of different ideas within a cohesive large-scale structure, something like a novel, which is something I'll come on to. But I think it fits perfectly, this idea of inclusion. But what he wants to do, and he sets it out very interestingly in a sort of manifesto in 1912, so 2 years before this premiere, is to write something that is inclusive, that, as I said, is for the people, is presenting London back to Londoners so that they can hear the sounds anew, and they can hear them raised up and made beautiful. He's wonderful at transmuting, at sort of changing ugliness into something beautiful. And so you have to be inclusive. You can't edit things out. You know, something that Virginia Woolf would balk at putting in a novel, Vaughan Williams will pile into a symphony. You know, we have the jingle of hansom cabs, and we have, you know, the Cockney whistling and the barrel organ and all these sounds. And he writes in the Royal College magazine in 1912, a lovely little article saying, it's all very well listening to foreign composers, but, you know, secondhand clothes tend not to fit very well, and things that flourish in foreign soil don't tend to do terribly well in native soil. And what you need to do, interestingly and very pertinently, is not necessarily just look to folk song for an English in inverted commas sound, but to take what you hear around you, to take the sounds in the street, to take what it sounds like to be English and transmute it into something very beautiful. And I think that's absolutely what he's achieved with the London Symphony.
He's also very keen to create a kind of symphony that's not Germanic.
Absolutely.
Because he felt that music, Elgar, much as he admired Elgar, he felt that Elgar was in the German tradition. And it's fascinating, if you look at critical reactions to Elgar's music before the First World War, some of his works were more enthusiastically received in Germany than they were here. Like, I have a copy of a score of a work called Der Traum des Gerontius. And when Strauss called Elgar the first English Meister, he didn't mean he's very good, he meant he's one of us. And that's something that you find in the German reviews of Elgar, this recognition that this is someone who's writing in our tradition and is good at it, which is very interesting if you compare to what happened later. Vaughan Williams felt it was very necessary to get away from German models. The German composer he revered was Bach. After that, he had great difficulty with a lot of the German figures, like Beethoven. He had a love-hate relationship with them. So, you know, it's very much about positioning himself in a different kind, or even inventing a tradition. Of course, he didn't know that Mahler was doing the same thing at the time, partly because in Vaughan Williams's time, Mahler was better known as a great conductor who also composed. Now we think of it the other way around, but actually, you know, it was Mahler conducting Tristan that had bowled Vaughan Williams over as a teenager, so yeah. He would remember Mahler preeminently as a conductor.
Now, he described this as his favourite symphony. Why do you think that was? What is there in this symphony to make it so satisfying for him?
I think it's just so full of life. And we've really got to bring in this question of this novel we've both been straining to mention here.
Absolutely. But
Vaughan Williams said that the end of the symphony was inspired by the closing pages of this novel by H.G. Wells called Tono Bungay, which is a kind of miracle cure-all tonic, which is actually basically worthless. It's a kind of parable about promotion and advertising and the way that you sell the product being more important than the product. But London is very much a character in Tono Bungay. In fact, approaching the last pages of the novel, Wells says, we now approach the great last movement in the London Symphony, which can't have escaped Vaughan Williams' attention. But there's a description where Wells says, the whole inimitable place teemed with suggestions of indefinite and sometimes outrageous possibilities of hidden but magnificent meanings. And you can see, almost being Vaughan Williams' motto for this symphony, as also, the characters remark about the narrators remark about the terror of the grim underside of London. That's there too. The novel is absolutely full of phrases which, if you know Vaughan Williams' writing, you realise made a huge impression on him. There's a classic one, a marvellous one, where someone asked him what he thought of composing, and he replied, "It's a rum go." At the climax of the novel, one of the leading characters, Aunt Susan, says to the hero, "Life, it's a rum go." And so, you know, for people who know Vaughan Williams and his writings and his work, reading this novel is a bit of there's an aha on every other page.
Yes, absolutely.
It's absolutely fascinating.
And there are so many wonderful parallels between the two. I think this idea of inclusivity, Wells is absolutely an inclusive writer, and he's very much criticised, particularly by the Bloomsbury Group, for it. He will put everything in there. He'll put the details of how to make some kind of nasty chemical. He'll put really quite dull details about machinery and mechanics. All sorts of things that would not be suitable for a novel go in, and it somehow works. And what he sets out quite self-consciously over and over again in Tono Bungay is the idea of writing a condition of England novel. I'm the central character, but really I'm more about decay, he says, of his central character. And England is about decay. London is decaying before my eyes. This is the rise and fall of a business empire.
The broad, but slow decay of the great social organism of England.
Absolutely, absolutely. This is a social organism in decay. Absolutely right. Mm. And this is what I mean about, you know, intellectuals all perceiving this kind of trajectory downwards before 1914, and Vaughan Williams' symphony is part of that. And it's rather fun to read the symphony as a novel, as a Condition of England novel, and to read Tono Bungay as a symphony, as it tells us it is. It's a London symphony. And Vaughan Williams makes this parallel explicit for us because when he's talking about the epilogue to his real London symphony, he quotes his own précis of the last few pages of Tono Bungay. It's an extraordinary ending to the book where the central character is going down the Thames on a destroyer that he's built himself. And of course, the significance of a destroyer, even though this is 1909, is clear.